Indian Lake, WXOQ, Bristol, Vermont, and WNYV, Whitehall, Glens Falls. It's 8 o'clock.
Good morning. This is Northern Light for Tuesday, March 26th. I'm Monica Sandreski.
And I'm Todd Moe.
Housing activists are packing Albany ahead of the April 1st budget deadline to push lawmakers to limit annual rent increases and the reasons why a landlord can evict a tenant.
There will be no comprehensive housing program without good cause eviction protections being built into it.
Governor Hochul, though, says the state just needs more housing.
Also, a forest ranger will recount a rescue during the snowstorm in the High Peaks this weekend. She says they found a hiker in a remote drainage area of Mount Marcy who was wet and his clothes and boots were frozen to his body.
A lot of people get lulled into thinking that they can take less and less gear with them. I don't think people often realize how closely they tread the line between a successful day out and tragedy.
Also, our book reviewer Betsy Capus shares thoughts about Brad Kessler's new novel, North. Set in Vermont, it intertwines the lives of a monk, a Somali refugee, and an Afghan war veteran. All that's coming up on Northern Light. Stick with us.
Broadcast of Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio is supported by Fisher, Bissett, Muldowney, and McArdle, attorneys and counselors at law, with offices in Malone, Tupper Lake, and Saranac Lake, 800-941-5001. And Adirondack Foundation, making grants to nonprofits that address community issues of childcare, attainable housing, career pathways, basic needs, and more. AdirondackFoundation.org.
This is Northern Light. I'm Monica Sandreski.
And I'm Todd Moe. The state budget is due by the end of this weekend. Housing activists are hoping to convince Governor Hochul and lawmakers to include new protections against evictions. But as WNYC's John Campbell reports for the New York Public News Network, their battle has been filled with ups and downs. Literally.
It's noon on a Tuesday, and dozens of activists are dressed in colorful T-shirts and wielding signs. They're waiting to hop on a busy escalator up to the main floor of the state capitol.
You guys, about mind if I ride this with you for a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely.
A state trooper watches as the demonstrators reach the top of the escalator and turn right around and head back down. And then up again. And then back down.
How long have you guys been doing this?
45 minutes.
It's state budget season in Albany, and every day activists and lobbyists are cramming into the Capitol building. Sometimes they've got to rely on interesting ways to attract lawmakers' attention amid a sea of people trying to do the same thing. This year, housing policy is in the spotlight, and it's why people like Dorca Reynoso of Inwood, Manhattan, are clogging up the escalator, trying to get their message across.
We want to slow them down to listen and take a moment to make sure that they understand the power of the tenants. We're here in high numbers, and they need to see that. They need to hear that.
They're pushing a measure known as good cause eviction. It would limit annual rent increases and prevent landlords from evicting a tenant without a good cause, like non-payment. Democratic lawmakers like Senator Mike Gianaris of Queens say it has to be part of a final housing deal.
There will be no comprehensive housing program without good cause eviction protections being built into it.
But the real estate industry hates the measure, and Governor Hochul has been hesitant to support it, too. She says the problem is supply. She wants to provide tax breaks to New York City developers and state grants to local governments that create new housing.
I'm going to be focused on building supply, and I'm certainly willing to have conversations, but it is very early in the process in terms of what will actually happen at the end of the day when the deal is struck.
Back at the Capitol, the activists keep up their protest well into the afternoon when suddenly...
Did they just shut down the escalator?
Yeah, they shut
it down. Yeah,
they shut down.
We're not stopping.
The protesters are totally unfazed. They keep trudging up and down, singing their songs. In Albany, I'm John Campbell for the New York Public News Network.
A 33-year-old man from New York City was lost overnight in the Adirondacks last weekend. He had planned to summit three high peaks, but then lost the trail after abandoning the second summit. The man was reported missing around 10 p.m. Friday and found around 10 a.m. on Saturday. Forest Ranger Robbie Meekus was one of the first people to find him and says he was lucky to be alive. She spoke with our Adirondack reporter, Emily Russell, about the rescue.
So the hiker set out Friday morning. His plan was to summit Mount Marcy, Skylight, and Gray. Those are three high peaks. There was a snowstorm in the forecast for Friday night. What do you know about the conditions that the man was prepared for when he set out for his hike?
So the conditions when he set out for his hike were probably 4 to 5 feet of snow near the summit of Mount Marcy, with probably 6 to 8 inches of fresh powder over older, harder snowpack. That's probably what he was walking in before the snowstorm hit.
So he did summit Mount Marcy, but then lost the trail after giving up on the second two high peaks. Is that accurate?
That's right. He summited Mount Marcy around 1:30. He texted his relative that he was on the summit of Mount Marcy and was continuing on. According to him, he went down and started going up Skylight and quickly realized that he did not have the time to finish all three.
So you were one of the first people to find him Saturday morning. What condition was he like when you found him?
I think it's important, before we even talk about that, to talk about the fact that if we did not find his tracks in the snow, he was in a location where people don't normally wind up there. It would not have been searched right away. It may have taken a couple of days to get rangers into that remote drainage back in there. And we were rapidly losing his tracks in the snowstorm. If we were 3 or 4 hours later, we would not have seen his tracks and we would not have found him. I think it's important to note just how lucky that was.
And what was he like when you first encountered him?
He was alert and conscious. He was very cold. He had fallen through the drainage multiple times. The drainage that he was following uphill. He had fallen through and gotten very wet. The drainages are not frozen. So he got very wet. He stopped when it got dark and found a small sort of hole in the snow between a boulder and a root. He was able to crawl into that hole and rest there. But his clothes froze to the outside of his body, and his boots froze to his feet. So when we found him, everything was frozen on top of him, and he was not really able to help himself at that point. He couldn't use his hands. He couldn't do anything other than stand there.
What lesson is there to be learned from this specific rescue? And is it similar to, other situations that folks get themselves in when they go hiking in the Adirondack High Peaks, particularly in winter conditions?
Yeah, so I think the lesson to learn is a vast majority of people who go out and hike, particularly in the winter, nothing ever happens. Their hike is successful. And that's fine. A lot of people get lulled into thinking that they can take less and less gear with them and still be safe. So I don't think people often realize how closely they tread the line between a successful day out in the mountains and tragedy. It's a very fine line. And I think the compounding factor in that is that you could have something go wrong, but if you're prepared to spend the night in the woods, that's something that went wrong, like let's say losing the trail, doesn't have to be a life-threatening ordeal.
We're expecting a lot of visitors during the solar eclipse, which is less than 2 weeks away. What do you want people to be thinking about as they prepare for that day, especially knowing, you, I imagine, and other forest rangers will be, on the alert for any potential search and rescues on that day or around that day?
Yeah, we will have people out at all the main trailheads going up to the high peaks. to sort of educate people about what kind of conditions to expect. And it's too early to tell what the forecast will be on April 8th, but there is a 100% chance that they will face winter conditions on the higher summits. It's a 100% chance. There is upwards of 5 to 6 feet still up on the higher summits in the high peaks, and that is not going to go away anytime soon. And nighttime, if somebody gets lost on their way down from viewing the eclipse on a high peak and they get lost on the way down or get hurt on the way down, they'll be experiencing, you know, sub-freezing winter conditions.
That was Forest Ranger Robbie Mekus speaking with Emily Russell. The DEC is urging people to avoid hiking in the high peaks for the solar eclipse. Lower elevations may be muddy and prone to erosion. Higher elevations will be icy and have multiple feet of snow.
Listening to Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio. It's 8:12. Good morning. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. Just ahead, Betsy Capis reviews Vermont writer Brad Kessler's novel North. That's in just a few minutes here on Northern Light.
Music by Dan Berggren. Weather Service says relatively mild temperatures today, mix of sun and clouds. Highs in the 50s for much of our region, east-southeast winds. Northern Light is supported by Long Run Wealth, an SEC-registered investment advisor in Lake Placid, providing comprehensive wealth management, retirement, and financial planning solutions. LongRunWealth.com.
Governor Kathy Hochul and her top aides announced the state's preparations for the upcoming solar eclipse on April 8th. The eclipse will be visible in much of the North Country and Western New York, 29 counties in all. At a press conference yesterday, the governor said while it promises to be a fun, once-in-a-generation event, people need to take some precautions and be prepared for traffic gridlock. Karen DeWitt reports.
Governor Hochul says state campgrounds will open early and are almost fully booked. There will be viewing events at state parks and historic sites. The Buffalo Bills have cut a special public service announcement, and the state has even compiled a special Spotify playlist, which includes this Beatles classic as well as some more modern choices for traveling to and from the event.
This is going to be great for our tourism. It's going to bring in thousands, if not millions, of people to localities all the way along the trajectory of this. It's going to be Jamestown and Buffalo and Niagara Falls and Plattsburgh and everything in between. So we're excited.
New York's Director of State Operations, Catherine Garcia, says if the weather cooperates, the eclipse promises to be a magical moment.
It's going to be breathtakingly beautiful. Everything transforms into twilight. There is a 360-degree sunset. Planets and stars will suddenly fill the sky. Birds and animals will go quiet. And a rare chance to see a solar corona, the sun's wispy outer atmosphere. It is really going to be an unforgettable moment.
But she says you need to take some precautions. By now, most people know that you can't look directly at the sun while the eclipse is happening, or you could permanently damage your eyes. You need special glasses. The state is making free protective glasses available at several throughway rest stops in the days leading up to the event. Garcia says if you purchase the glasses elsewhere, make sure they're safe and they'll protect your eyes.
Literally, if you can see your hand in front of your face with the glasses on, if you can see, they're not good. If you try these, you cannot see anything unless you are staring directly at the sun.
And she says if you have kids with you, make sure they don't look directly at the sun by mistake. Jackie Bray, the state's commissioner of Homeland Security, says they're treating the eclipse like any mass event. They're staffing up state police and thruway and Department of Transportation officials to deal with traffic management. More tow trucks and help trucks with supplies, including extra gasoline, will be on hand.
We absolutely expect significant gridlock. You will be in traffic for several hours. It is still an absolutely worthwhile thing to do, but we want to make sure that you stay patient.
Bray recommends making use of the state's 511 number for advice about alternative routes if the roads are clogged. And she says if you're traveling to western or northern New York for the eclipse, it might be better to come a day early for the event and stay a day late. She says cell phone service might be overloaded at times during the event, but she says 911 will work. For those who are trying to go about their normal day, Bray says working from home is a good idea and you should consider canceling any scheduled appointments. On the day of the eclipse, they recommend you should plan to get to your destination early and to stay late to avoid the traffic jams and bring snacks.
Black hole sun, won't you come?
The total eclipse is the first one visible in New York since 1925. There won't be another one until 2079. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt for the New York Public News Network.
You can find eclipse events throughout the North Country and more information about what the total solar eclipse will be like. Head to our landing page, ncpr.org/eclipse.
And if you've got astronomy questions, and you know you do, about the total solar eclipse, email them to us, news@ncpr.org. Astronomer Eileen O'Donohue joins us on the show next Tuesday, that's a week from today, to answer our questions. So get them to us right now. Email your questions about the solar eclipse, the totality. You can email them to us, news@ncpr.org.
A food plant in Lewis County is expected to get $20 million in federal funding for upgrades to the facility. According to Senator Chuck Schumer, the Kraft Heinz plant in Lowville is one of 10 Kraft facilities around the country that will get tens of millions of dollars from the Department of Energy. The money will go towards heat pumps and other clean energy infrastructure at the plant. In all, Kraft Heinz is getting $170 million from the federal government. The president of the company says they hope to have net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050.
Here's a sure sign of spring. The St. Lawrence Seaway reopened for the season yesterday. The Seaway is a major route for commerce. Cargo ships transport more than 130 million tons of freight between the Atlantic Ocean and the Great Lakes per year. According to a press release from the Department of Transportation, it also supports about $35 million in economic activity each year in the U.S. and Canada. This year also marks the 70th anniversary of the Wiley-Dondero Seaway Act that allowed the two countries to create a channel between Montreal and Ogdensburg and complete the seaway system.
And for the second time in about a decade, a basketball player from Glens Falls has made it into the Sweet 16 bracket of March Madness. Joe Girard III is a senior at Clemson University. Clemson is the sixth seed to win the tournament and will face the number two seeded Alabama on Thursday. Jimmer Fredette was also in his senior year at BYU when his team made the Sweet 16. Fredette was considered one of the best college basketball players that year. His team lost to Florida in overtime back in 2011.
You're listening to Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. In just a minute, Vermont writer Brad Kessler's latest novel, North, is a timely story about the search for sanctuary. And we've got a review coming up. Then stick around after the show for Bird Note, just ahead at 8:42. First, Todd has a look at the weather.
We've got clouds and some sunshine today. A mix of clouds and sun, highs ranging from the upper 40s, low 50s in places like Glens Falls and Lake George to the upper 50s, low 60s in the St. Lawrence Valley, Champlain Valley, east-southeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour, maybe an occasional higher gust. Tonight, mostly cloudy, some light showers likely, overnight lows around 40, and then tomorrow about a 50-60% chance of scattered rain, highs again upper 50s near 60. Thursday and Friday, it'll be cooler, partly to mostly cloudy skies, highs in the 40s, and at this point, the weekend forecast, Saturday partly cloudy, and some isolated snow showers possible on Sunday with highs in the low to mid 40s. Right now, we've got partly sunny skies, 35 degrees here in Canton. North, a novel by Brad Kessler, imagines a Somali refugee hiding in a Vermont monastery. Our book reviewer, Betsy Capis, talked with me about the book.
Todd, Kessler's novel follows the lives of three very different characters. There's an American man who lives in a cloistered order of monks in Vermont, a Somali woman who's escaping the chaos in Mogadishu, and a Vermonter who's an injured veteran.
Okay, so how do these three people all get in the same book?
Yeah, it's a strange mix. So it begins with a May snowstorm, which happens in Vermont, and a car goes off the road. And that car holds Saro, who's a young woman who's fled from Somalia, and a volunteer driver who's taking her to Canada secretly. The two women are discovered by Teddy Fletcher, who's the groundskeeper of the 800-acre Blue Mountain Monastery in high, upper-level Vermont. Mm-hmm. The weather's so bad that Teddy decides to let the women shelter at an empty building on the grounds of the monastery.
Hmm. Now, that sounds like it's probably against the monastery rules.
It's most definitely. Yeah. Just men and nobody else
right.
is supposed to be there.
Right.
So when Teddy tells Father Christopher about what he has done, the monk requests that he keep that information away from the rest of the monks and that he, so he can think about what to do. Here's Teddy, the groundskeeper. Teddy was used to Christopher's silence, his slow way of considering things. All the men on Blue Mountain seemed to operate on a slower RPM, everything moving at half speed. The exact opposite of the military, where decisions were made in a snap and reactions came swiftly, where if you contemplated anything too long, you ended up dead.
So what does Father Christopher decide to do?
Well, there are prayers, of course. And while Father Christopher is making a decision, there's lots of backstory on Saro. After her parents were murdered when she was a young child, she lived out in the desert with her grandparents. When drought destroyed their herding lives, she was sent to live with an aunt in Mogadishu. Kessler writes, Saro didn't recognize the city of her birth when she returned there at 11 years old. Zamar, the capital, frightened her. The rubble and ruined buildings, the armed men in Toyotas and Jeeps, the loud market with its colorful crowds and piles of electronics and melons and cut-up fish. She was used to the northern scrublands, the Houd, the quiet country, the camel's pace.
Let's back up a little bit. And how does Saro end up in Vermont?
Well, this was one of the most tragic parts of a tragic story.
Mm-hmm.
After her cousin is killed in a bomb attack in Mogadishu, and Saro's only a teenager, she wants to leave Somalia before she's killed, too. Her journey's horrifying, and it takes up many pages of this novel. She flies to South America and then has to find a way to get north. At the Mexican-U.S. border, she asks for sanctuary, but instead she's arrested and sent to a detention center in New York City where she lives for 2 years.
Wow, 2 years?
Yeah. She has to wait for her case to come up. Never going outside. And she's finally allowed to leave the prison, but must wear a monitor on her leg. when her case is denied, she decides she just will get to Canada. She has relatives there. So a volunteer picks her up and gives her a tool to cut the monitor off her leg, and then they head north for the border.
Mm. Okay, back to the monastery. What does Father Christopher decide to do?
It is a dilemma for him. Mm-hmm. Sarreau is a fugitive, and ICE officials saw the car off the road and suspect it was used to transport a person who's in the United States illegally. One of the most shocking scenes in the book is when ICE send a drone to spy on the monastery. Hmm. It felt like a real trespass on the solitude and isolation of the monks. They're at prayer when it hovers at their window. Here's Kessler. At the guest house, Sarreau sat by the kitchen window texting Aunt Wardo when something silverly caught her eye on the lawn. The flying object was too large and slow to be a bird. She dashed down the hall into the bedroom, closed the door, and lay flat beneath the bed. The unmanned aerial vehicle lifted majestically above the guest house and cloister, above the apple orchard and access road, above all the monastery lands and beyond. It flew with a bird's eye view, with impunity, over all the acreage and surrounding land, mastering all within its range. Wingless, minatory, it circled the mountain summit, the communication towers, the old fire station. It saw through its camera all the way east to New Hampshire and west to New York and north into Canada over all the native lands.
Wow, that is just creepy. I mean, it almost sounds alien or something. So does Sarreau make it to Canada?
You know, Todd, I'm not going to answer that question. But I will say I think Kessler created a rich character in Sarreau. She is afraid of everyone for good reason. And she finds comfort in reading her Quran, the only book she owns. That pairs really well with Father Christopher, who consults his Christian texts as he decides what must be done. They come from such different worlds, but they really respect each other.
Wow. Thanks for your thoughts, Betsy.
It's my pleasure, Todd.
Our book reviewer, Betsy Capis, lives, reads, and writes in Colton, and she shared her thoughts about the novel North by Vermont writer Brad Kessler. It's published by the Overlook Press. Time is coming up on 28 minutes past 8, and you're listening to North Country Public Radio. Just want to pass along a couple of events to you. Coming up on Tuesday, March 26th, that's today, 6 o'clock tonight, at the Potsdam Public Library, What is Home? Housing and the North Country, featuring Erin Dorney. You can hear more about her What is Home and Housing in the North Country, her zine as well. She'll be at the Potsdam Public Library tonight at 6 o'clock. And also, in terms of libraries, the Messina Library has a community mosaic tile project on Saturday, March 30th, from 10 to 2. You're welcome to stop by the Messina Public Library and help design a tile to be part of the community mosaic at the Museum Public Library. That's coming up this Saturday from 10 to 2.
And there are a couple of eclipse events going on in the region today. This afternoon at the Ogdensburg Public Library, Dr. Benjamin Ralston, he's a Clarkson professor, has a PhD in astronomy. He's speaking about the upcoming eclipse. That's this afternoon from 2:30 to 4 at the Ogdensburg Public Library. You can find out more at their website. And also this evening at St. Lawrence University in Canton at the Sykes Formal Lounge, Perry Ground, he's a storyteller from the Turtle Clan of the Onondaga Nation. He's been telling stories for 25 years to educate people about culture and beliefs and the history of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. And this evening, he's going to bring Native American stories and traditions to Canton. You can find out more from stlawu.edu and from Nature Up North, who is presenting the event. That is storyteller Perry Ground, coming to St. Lawrence University.
And that's it for Northern Light. Stay tuned. More of Morning Edition just ahead.
And join us for a conversation at lunchtime today on Fresh Air. Tens of millions of Americans could end up moving to escape rising seas and oppressive heat. We'll hear more of that conversation between noon and 1 right here on North Country Public Radio.